Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, European and RCVS specialist in veterinary neurology, Sebastian Baer. Thank you, Sebastian. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you for joining this webinar. So what we're going to do for the next hour or so is we're going to talk about acute paralysis in dogs mostly. We'll have what we call a case-based approach. So we will see clinical cases, you know, and cover some, you know, common condition, you know, together. So we'll jump straight into the first case. That's a crossbred male, entire 4 years, 6 months old. He's been running the park on a nice sunny day and suddenly, you know, sort of yelped, you know, and went off his legs. Prior to this, there was no issues in terms of mobility, and, you know, it happened really as an acute onset. So he was brought, you know, to the practice straight away after the incident, and that's how he is presented to you. So you can see that this dog is in lateral recumbency, you know, so he's not only, you know, paralyzed in the back legs, but he can't really stand. And what is important to pay attention to is this hyperextension of the forelimbs. And this posture, you know, in association, you know, with the good sensorium, the ability to move the neck, is highly, highly suggestive of what we would call a Schiff Sherrington posture. So that's tell you, you know, a couple of things. If a patient arrives in Schiff Sherrington, but you know it's an acute spinal injury, it doesn't happen, you know, with progressive, you know, or chronic spinal cord injury, and it has to be, you know, a thoracolumbar, you know, lesion. It can't basically be a lesion caudal to L3, you know, or cranial, you know, to T3. Now, on the next video, it will basically confirm, you know, the fact that it's mostly the pelvic limb affected. And you will see that when we try to make that patient walk, that we can see very well that, you know, he's pretty much dragging his back legs. There's no voluntary movement, so he's paraplegic, but he does have some very good movement and placing in the thoracic limbs. So again, you know, the fact that he couldn't stand is due to this Schiff Sherrington posture, but all, you know, the examination at the moment is more suggestive of pelvic limb paralysis or, you know, paraplegia. Now, the next step after having done that, you know, you can see that he's literally dragging his feet, you know, so he's got no proprioception in the pelvic limb. The next step will be to test, you know, his segmental spinal reflexes, which is what we're going to see in the next video. Now, in terms of supporting his weight, you know, he can't really weight bear, you know, so we will support his weight with our hand, you know, to test, you know, again, his paw placement, even if we have a good impression from the previous video that he wouldn't be able, I'd say, to, you know, perform the paw placement. So he's got absent proprioception in both pelvic limbs. And we retest it, you know, several times. And again, when we do that, we support the patient's weight. And we can also see that trying to test the flexor withdrawal, again, that's a reflex. We're not testing the nociception here. We are just testing the flexor withdrawal. You know, it seems, you know, very, very weak. So he's not pulling, you know, the leg. So now we'll have the patient in lateral recumbency to try and test, you know, the reflexes a bit more precisely. Now, we can appreciate that the tone in the pelvic limb is markedly reduced. You know, there's no resistance at all. Again, we are going to test that flexor withdrawal reflex, which seems pretty much absent, to be fair. You know, even by increasing, you know, the stimulation, it doesn't seem to have, you know, a flexor withdrawal. Now, we'll test our patella, and the patella is present. And the important step will be, obviously, because he's got no voluntary movement, we clearly want to know, does he have nociception or not? You know, so patients that do still have voluntary movement are very likely to have nociception preserved, but patients with paraplegia or tetraplegia can lose nociception. But we can see that it definitely can feel pain. You know, so the nociception is, you know, the awareness, you know, of a painful stimulus. So it's a behavioral response of the patient. And even if he's not withdrawing the leg, you know, he can clearly feel, you know, that we are doing something painful. So in terms of, you know, the next step, but we strongly suspect a thoracolumbar injury. The only thing that's a bit odd is this lack of flexor withdrawal. Now, with our posture that we had at the beginning, the shift Sherrington posture, we basically suspect, again, you know, more like a T3L3 lesion. So another way, you know, to somehow confirm that is to test our cutaneous tronchi reflex. So we will see that on the next video. Now, using forceps, we just gave a light pinch on the skin, and normally the skin should flinch all the way down to the wings of the ilium. Now, we can see that this patient has what we would call like a cutaneous tronchi cutoff, you know, quite clearly around the last rib. So despite the fact that he has a decreased withdrawal, you know, the primary lesion, you know, is very much, you know, a thoracolumbar lesion, so a transverse myelopathy, you know, around the thoracolumbar junction. Now, if you have a strong history of trauma, you suspected that that might have had an RTA, and you don't want to make the dot stand and walk like we did in the second video, and but you suspect a shift Sherrington posture, you know, one way, you know, to sort of confirm your thoracolumbar lesion will simply be, you know, to do as we just did there, you know, to test your cutaneous tronchi reflex in lateral recumbency, and that would again reinforce your suspicion in terms of localization. Now, based on all of this, you know, we'll try and put everything together, but the first step is obviously to try and get an idea of the anatomic diagnosis, so where is the lesion. Now, as we've discussed, you know, shift Sherrington is not a prognosis indicator. It tells you that it's an acute lesion in the thoracolumbar, you know, area. Plus, we do have a cutaneous tronchi cutoff, so our anatomic diagnosis, you know, would be, you know, more a T3L3 lesion. And in terms of grading, you know, we have a patient that still does have nociception present. Because it's such an acute onset, and there was no, you know, pre-existing condition, you know, our main, you know, differential would be either, you know, an acute disc herniation, but mostly contusion of the spinal cord rather than compression, and we call that an ANP. Or, you know, an ischemic myelopathy, you know, also called FCE, or less likely, you know, regarding the paracute onset, would be like a disc extrusion, so Hansen type 1. Now, going back to, you know, the presentation of that patient, the only thing that is slightly unusual for a thoracolumbar lesion is the lack of withdrawal reflex, you know, which is slightly unexpected. Now, in the same way as the shift Sherrington, you can have in really acute spinal cord, you know, lesion, something that we call spinal shock. And the spinal shock may lead to decreased segmental spinal reflexes, especially, you know, the flexor withdrawal, despite having, you know, a thoracolumbar lesion. So the important factors in that patient is to identify the posture, identify the cutaneous tronchi cutoff, and obviously check the nociception. But the lack of withdrawal reflex is not necessarily the sign of a lower motor neuron anatomic diagnosis. It's more the sign of spinal shock due to the severity and the acuteness of the lesion. Now, the condition that we commonly face, you know, with those paracute paralysis, especially associated with exercise, but it's been labeled in different way in the literature. So you could have, you know, acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion, you know, so the ANP. It's also been referred sometimes to traumatic disc or low volume, high velocity. That would trace the fact that, again, it's a small amount of disc that will somehow, you know, hit the spinal cord at high speed and causes bruising. Now, all of those will refer to the same condition. Sometimes it's even been, you know, referred to as Hansen type 3, you know, but that's not, you know, accepted. And overall, in those patients, the contusion of the spinal cord is much, much, much greater than the compression. So you do not tend to have a large amount of disc that will cause nerve root or spinal cord compression. You have a small amount of disc, you know, that will cause bruising or contusion. Now, the accepted terminology in the, is, you know, unfortunately the longest of the three. But the good thing about it is that it tells you exactly what happened. So it's an acute lesion of the spinal cord that is non-compressive, you know, due to an extrusion of the nucleus pulposus. And in those cases, there is no pre-existing degeneration. So it's not like your dachshund that goes off his legs due to a degeneration and a subsequent Hansen type 1 disc extrusion. Those dogs, as we can see on this MRI, they do have actually fully hydrated nucleus. So there's no pre-existing degeneration. But what we can see is that there's usually a reduced volume of the nucleus and associated hyperintensity in the spinal cord, signs of the contusion edema. This condition can also happen in cats, and it's a very similar history in those cases with an acute onset of pelvic limb paralysis that needs to be clearly differentiated from your aortic thrombus. So, palpating the pulses in those cats is very important. And as you can see on this scan, it's the same process where the volume of the nucleus is reduced, there is no signs of degeneration, and you have associated intramedullary contusion causing the signs of paralysis. Now, we are now going to see another video just to show you something not dissimilar. So that dog has a pretty similar history, running the park on a sunny day, trying to chase a ball, playing with his owner, and then suddenly struggling to stand and walk. The difference with the previous case, if you look at that dog, mostly has monoplegia. So one limb is very, very severely affected with almost no voluntary movement at all. And the other leg is actually remarkably good in the sense that he's not knuckling and he can actually place the paw properly. So when you have such an acute onset of a lateralized lesion, one leg being severely affected, plegic in that case, and the other leg pretty much normal, we have to think about the possibility of a vascular compromise. Why is that? But if you had a compressive lesion of the spinal cord, it would be far, far less likely to have such a discrepancy between one leg and the other. So if you have a spinal cord injury causing such signs of monoplegia or severe monoparesis, we would highly suspect something that we call an ischemic myelopathy. And the onset is very, very similar to those dogs with ANP. The difference in those cases is that we don't really have extrusion of the disc. We actually have more an ischemia, which is a compromise to the arterial supply of a segment of the spinal cord due to small embolism of cartilage. And again, I think there would be a very, very sort of similar history and an overlap somehow in their presentation. More commonly with FCE, we will tend to have an asymmetry of the signs, probably a bit more than with the ANP. And on the MRI, then you will see a similar story where the disc is normally hydrated and you have purely an intramedullary lesion. So it's not a compressive spinal cord injury, as is due again to a lack of blood supply to segments of the spinal cord. Now, is it important to differentiate the two because they are so similar in onset, and somehow the recovery is not that dissimilar. It will mainly be supportive care, and we can see that in terms of prognosis in a recent study performed with the Animal Health Trust, but most dogs will regain ambulation. There is nonetheless persistent motor deficits in roughly 84% of dogs with presumptive ANP. And probably a tiny bit more with dogs with FCE. Now, an important thing is possibly in terms of differentiating the two would be a prediction of fecal incontinence. And it seems that it's five times more likely for dogs suffering from this acute nucleus pulposus extrusion to have fecal incontinence in comparison with dogs with purely FCE. And that may clearly have a bearing for the client. So I think somehow it's not just academic, it may help to predict a higher likelihood of fecal incontinence with dog with NP with a similar grade and a similar presentation. Now, obviously, our third differential, so we went through the ANP, or this disc extrusion with mostly contusion of the spinal cord. Then we've discussed the ischemic myelopathy, or FCE, which is a lack of blood supply. But with acute paralysis in a patient like we have just seen, you could possibly have an Hansen type 1 disc herniation. And Hansen type 1 would be the picture on the left side of the screen where you actually have an extrusion of the degenerated nucleus. In those cases, there is an underlying degeneration of the nucleus, what we call a chondroid degeneration, and subsequent extrusion. There's usually a very painful part, and the painful part is not necessarily the compression, especially if it's midline. It's usually more the disruption of the fibers of the annulus. And the history, you know, is not that commonly paracute. It's usually starting with a bit of pain, reluctant to exercise, and either a few hours after or a few days after, you know, a sort of an acute or progressive onset of neurological signs. In those cases, with the Hansen type 1 disc extrusion, what you do have is a spinal cord injury that is both compressive, you know, due to the volume of disc that is extruded, and, you know, a contusion associated as well. Now, Hansen type 1 is probably something, you know, that you're quite familiar with, you know, and you probably know that some breed are more, you know, affected than others, as you can see on this picture. This little chap probably has other, you know, predisposing factor, you know, than just, you know, the genetics. I think the weight in that case it probably didn't help. Now, those dogs that are more commonly affected are referred to chondroid dystrophic dogs, so they are more prone to a chondroid degeneration of the nucleus, you know, that will lead to those disc extrusion. But you could also have Hansen type 1 disc herniation, you know, in a non-chondroid dystrophic dog, so it's not you know, an exclusion of those. Where do those discs tend to happen? But it's mostly around the thoracolumbar junction. So 65% of all disc extrusion, you know, will be between, you know, T11 and L2. You know, so it's quite common that they are presented with, you know, T3, L3 signs, you know, ranging from paraparesis to paraplegia. You will see that the age onset is relatively young, and that's because this degeneration, you know, is not an age-related degeneration. It's actually a genetic mutation leading, you know, to a fairly early degeneration. And there's commonly pain, you know, associated with it, again, because of the process of extrusion that has somehow to disrupt, you know, the fibers of the annulus. That will be, you know, significantly painful for the patient. And yes, it will be acute, usually not necessarily as paracute as the ANP or the FC, and less likely, you know, asymmetrical. Now, it's important with your neuro exam, obviously, to try and, you know, get an anatomic diagnosis. And in that case, you know, we've seen that we had pointers leading to a T3L3 lesion, and somehow we had slightly misleading findings with our segmental spinal reflexes, you know, showing a decreased withdrawal. But again, in the case of an acute lesion, do you think about the spinal shock if you have other, you know, findings supportive of a T3L3 lesion? It's obviously very important to assess the severity of the lesion and to communicate that clearly to, you know, the owner. And you will see on that diagram that if you look at the nociceptive fibers, you know, which are the red dot, you know, very much towards the center of the spinal cord, those fibers are the one, you know, that will be affected if you have a patient that is paraplegic with no deep pain or paraplegic with absent nociception. So that does trace an extremely severe, you know, spinal cord injury, whether it's compression or bruising or the combination of the two. Now, in terms of the recovery, you know, it will tend to progress, you know, the other way around. So the injury is most commonly, you know, from proprioception to then loss of motor function, loss of bladder control, and then potentially loss of nociception. Recovery-wise, what we will monitor initially in those patients will be recovery of the nociception, then recovery of bladder control, motor function, and at the end, recovery of the proprioception. Now, one specific aspect of the neuro exam is that you can potentially have an idea of the prognosis, you know, depending on your assessment and mostly depending on the presence or absence of the nociception. That table is very useful if you want to discuss the option with your client when you strongly suspect an Hansen type 1 disc extrusion. So classically, you know, a dachshund, you know, that suddenly went off his back legs, and, you know, you want to discuss with them the chances of recovery with either conservative or surgical management. Just very briefly, in terms of grading, we have grade ranging from 1 to 5. Grade 1 is a dog that is just painful with no neural deficit. Grade 2 is a dog that has very mild neural deficit. Grade 3 is a patient that has clear gait abnormality. That ranges from ambulatory to non-ambulatory, but it will have voluntary movement. So if you support the patient, you will see movement of the limb. Grade 4 is a patient that is paraplegic. Grade 5 is a patient that is paraplegic with absent nociception. Now, if we compare conservative and surgical, we'll see that for grade 1, you know, it definitely makes sense to treat conservatively. All of them will tend to improve with pain relief. But what it doesn't take into account is roughly a third of those dogs will relapse. And they may relapse with pain, or they may relapse at any other grade. Whereas surgery, even if you do have 97% of them that will improve, you know, unfortunately, surgery can have complications, as I'm sure you understand. But that will actually prevent, assuming you know the surgery is associated with fenestration, will tend to prevent further extrusion at the same site. Now, for grade 2 and 3, with conservative and surgery, it's very, very similar in the sense that 84% of them will improve with conservative over 6 weeks. With surgery, probably a slightly greater percentage will improve, and they will tend to improve more quickly. Now, looking at the last two grades, now the grade 4, we clearly see that, yes, it's possible to treat conservatively when a patient is paraplegic, but it may take up to 3 months. And it means that the owners will need to be prepared to nurse a plegic patient with all the nursing care, bladder management, and you know, preventing complications like UTIs, pressure sores, for up to 3 months. So it's a big, big, big commitment in terms of time and dedication, but also you know, a substantial possible, you know, financial commitment. Now, if we look at the surgery, we still have 95% of them, you know, that will improve, and that will tend to improve usually, you know, within a month. You know, so it's a quicker recovery with still, you know, a very good outcome. Now, if we look at our grade 5, this is your patient that is paraplegic, and you're confident that on testing the nociception, you know, there is no behavioral response of your patient, so you can't feel pain in the pelvic limbs. Now, conservative is not indicated in those cases. You know, we have less, you know, than 10% of patients that can improve. And with surgery, assuming steps are taken, you know, within, you know, the first 48 hours of the injury, we have up to, you know, 60-65% of dogs that will make a satisfactory recovery. But again, if you look at the time, it is a substantial, you know, time of recovery compared to a grade 4. You know, so it's more than doubled when you have lost nociception. That again means that the owners need to be able to provide, you know, the necessary supportive care after the surgery. If you know, this is left too long, and if you know, not the patient that is DPEN negative is only operated on after, you know, a couple of days, then the chances of recovery tend to be less. Even if this, you know, is starting to be slightly challenged by new papers on that matter, I think that still, you know, would be important that those patients are dealt with, you know, in a timely fashion, and ideally, you know, within the first 48 hours after injury. Now, if you have to manage those dogs conservatively, it would be associating non-steroidals anti-inflammatory, possibly with paracetamol or paracetamol in replacement if the patient can't receive NSAIDs or does tend to have gastrointestinal signs, for example. And then it would be wise to add gabapentin in case of spinal pain, 10 to 20 mg per kg every 8 hours. And it's usually advised that those patients are, you know, strictly rested, like proper cage rest for 4 weeks with lead walks only, you know, including the toilet walks. Physiotherapy can be started and can be demonstrated to the owner, or you know, they can eventually go to a physio center, you know, for that to be demonstrated. If we are looking at the possibility of surgery, but we will tend to consider surgery if the patient is not responding to conservative and the signs keep reoccurring, or if he's deteriorating, or if the owners are keen for investigation, you know, even with a low grade, and there is significant spinal cord compression and imaging, or eventually in the cases of paraplegia with loss of nociception, as we've seen, you know, on the table. Now, looking at the technique that will tend to be used if we are looking at decompressing the spinal cord after a Hansen type 1 in a spinal cord injury, what we would basically do in most cases would be a hemilumpectomy. It means that we would remove, you know, part of the articular facet and the lamina, and we will do what we would call a decompressive surgery to remove the disc, and also associate that with fenestration, to reduce the risk of a further disc extrusion. There would be, as you can see, a list of all the techniques that can be performed, but classically for dogs with Hansen type 1 disc extrusion, mini hemilaminectomy or hemilaminectomy are the most common. If we are looking at other techniques described yesterday, corpectomy would mean that we would purely, somehow access the disc from ventrally without opening the vertebral canal laterally or dorsally. That's more commonly done with disc protrusion, but can also be done, with Hansen type 1 disc extrusion, assuming the disc distribution is at the level of, the disc space. Now, again, in terms of what we try to achieve is to decompress the spinal cord, and we've mentioned that the injury is a combination of contusion and compression, so that means that there will obviously be a delay in the recovery following surgery due to the healing process of the spinal cord following decompression. Fenestration is very important to be performed in association with the hemilaminectomy. There is reasonably good prospective study on that, and the risk of further extrusion if the fenestration is performed is probably less than 4% of the same disc space. But if the fenestration is not performed, then the risk of further extrusion is somewhere between 10 and 30%. So, a significant risk of either reoccurrence of some of the neurosigns or pain due to further extrusion. Corpectomy, we have mentioned that another technique that can be done, that's just a 3D rendering CT scan of a dog who had three corpectomies, but that was more to treat disc protrusion. Again, that can be done with Hansen type 1 disc herniation, but it's less commonly performed. Vertebral stabilization, that would rarely be done for disc disease, unless there is a strong suspicion of associated instability, which is not the case in dogs with Hansen type 1. But if you have a spinal trauma, potentially with fracture luxation, then stabilization, most commonly done with pedicle screws and bone cement, would be a logical step. In terms of implantation of the implant, it's well documented that there is some corridors to somehow avoid vital structures like obviously the vertebral canal and the aorta. In sort of helping with that, it's now possible to use a 3D printed patient guide that will somehow help you to place your implants by missing those structures. So those are patient specific, and they will require the patient to have and not only an MRI, but ideally have a CT scan to plan appropriately the design of those implants. Now, we have seen the dogs that can have a contusion of the spinal cord due to an NP, ischemic lesion with an FC, a disc extrusion, and how this can be dealt with surgically. Now I'm going to show you another case, and that's a Dachshund that it's more progressive. It has not been right for a couple of weeks, and it started with pain. Then he started to have difficulty using his pelvic limb. And that difficulty using his pelvic limb, progress to the point of not being able to ambulate in the pelvic limb at all. And then, continued to get worse. And they probably reckon that he hasn't really been able to walk, for the last 36 hours. And he also seems very painful, quite depressed. And also he seems to be struggling to breathe. So I'll show you a couple of those videos. So that's our middle-aged Dachshund. And we can see that he's definitely not able to stand, and use his pelvic limb, very well. But there's another thing is that the thoracic limbs are also abnormal, not to the same extent, but you can see he's almost using his nose, to support his weight. So there's also a degree of paresis or weakness in the thoracic limb. So we'll probably say, tetraparesis more severe in the pelvic limb. Now, looking at the next video, what we basically can see is that when we try and support his weight again, he's really, really struggling to weight bear in the thoracic limbs. And you will see that the weakness is probably more evident on that video. We can also see that he has lack of bow placement And there's also signs of, as I support him, signs of dribbling of urine. And again, see how he's supporting, you know, his weight. If you also pay attention to his head, obviously you can see that he looks like a very unhappy dachshund, but you can also see protrusions of the third eyelid. And that was present on both sides. You know, so we start to have a suspicion of something that is a bit more complex than just a T3L3 lesion. Now we'll have a look at the next video. And on that video, what we try and do is, as we've seen with the previous patient, we are testing the flexor withdrawal. And again, the flexor withdrawal in that patient is very poor. We are going to try and test his patellar reflex. His patellar is present, but withdrawal again was pretty much absent. Now, the next step is not to look at the leg movement, but look at the behavior of the patient and see if he can feel pain. And it seemed that there is a very poor, you know, response to nociception. You know, so in this case, you know, we have a patient that has signs in all four limbs, also seems, you know, to have Horner syndromes and seems to have absence nociception in the pelvic limbs. Now, on the next video, you know, we are going to test another reflex that we saw before, which is our cutaneous troncha reflex. And all along, what we can see that cutaneous troncha reflex is completely absent. So there's no cutoff at any stage. It's just absent all along, you know, the thoracolumbar spine. So the only, you know, possible explanation, you know, if we were to look at our anatomic diagnosis, you know, would be something extremely diffuse, you know, so something that would be not only affected, you know, one segment of the spinal cord, but something affecting a huge area of, you know, the spinal cord. Why is that? But first of all, you know, all four limbs are affected, even if the pelvic limbs are more affected than the thoracic. So, you know, we have a patient that is tetraparetic, but we also have absence of withdrawal in the pelvic limb. So that traces, you know, lower motor neuron signs in the pelvic limb. We also have an absent cutaneous troncha reflex. We also have an absent Horner. And all of this, you know, would be consistent with caudal cervical and cervical lesion. And that dog, you know, unfortunately had something that we call myelomalacia. And in those cases, what tends to happen is that after an acute spinal cord injury, you know, usually thoracolumbar spinal cord injury, you have ascending, descending myelomalacia. What is really crucial in those patients is to try and identify the progression of the signs. So if you have a patient that has a clear T3L3 anatomic diagnosis and the day after he starts to lose his flexor withdrawal in the pelvic limbs, or he does tend to have a cutaneous tronchi cutoff that seems to go upwards, you know, or more cranial, then, you know, you have to be wary of the development of myelomalacia. And this is unfortunately, you know, a condition, you know, that is progressive, but you can't stop, you know, with any treatment, and it will be fatal due to the fact that it will actually impair the patient's ability to ventilate. That tends to happen in roughly 10 to 15% of the grade 5 patient with Hansen type 1 disc herniation. And unfortunately, you know, because, you know, it is a necrosis of the spinal cord following an acute spinal cord injury, it is not a reversible process, regardless, you know, of what you do. So if you suspect this from a clinical examination, there's clearly no indication, you know, for this patient, you know, to have surgery. But it's also something that can happen, unfortunately, following surgery. So even, you know, if the surgery is performed and the decompression is performed, due to somehow the contusion and the intramedullary changes at the time of the spinal cord injury, those patients may still develop, you know, myelomalacia despite, you know, decompressive surgery. The very last case is a Welsh Terrier, five years old. He has probably not been totally right, maybe a bit slower for a week, but it's really over the last 2 days that he really struggled to walk. You know, so there's been a fairly acute onset over 2 days of walking around reasonably happily to a dog that you will see in a minute. The owners do not report any trauma, no injury, nothing out of the routine, and there's no signs of pain. Now, let's have a look at this last case. Now, what we can see that even with support, that patient is unable to move any of his limb. So he's what we would call tetraplegic. In terms of his sensorium, he's slightly depressed, but he's still alert and responsive. What we can also see that there is a slight difficulty in supporting his head. So there is a profound weakness, you know, and that would be, you know, the striking feature of, you know, that gait or absence of gait, is that it's not only the tetraplegia, but is really the profound weakness affecting all the limbs and also affecting, you know, the muscle of the neck. On the next video, we are going to test his paw placement, so proprioception testing. And as we would strongly suspect, this seems to be absent in the thoracic limbs. And you see he absolutely struggles, you know, just to lift his head up. And the paw placement also seems absent in the pelvic limb. Now, the next video, we will see the segmental spinal reflexes. So the muscle tone is very weak. As he can't weight bear, and we can see that there's no resistance when we do the flexion. There's no signs of flexor withdrawal. Patella is present, but probably slightly decreased. Tibia cranial again seems to be decreased. Now, as he has no movement, what we want to see is can he feel properly? And we can clearly see again, then don't look at the leg, look at the dog's head, that he has good nociception. So no withdrawal, but clearly he can feel, you know, a painful stimulus. And again, thoracic limb, we have really poor flexor withdrawal. Now, if we were to think about the possibility of the location of the lesion or anatomic diagnosis, what we would probably say is that he's got signs in all four limbs that are very similar, with decreased tone in all four limbs, decrease flexor withdrawal in all four limbs, and a nociception that is present. So he has lower motor neuron signs in both the pelvic limb and the thoracic limb. So that would be very, very difficult to explain just with a spinal lesion. And in that case, you know, we would be highly you know, suspicious of something that we would call, you know, a neuromuscular disease. And neuromuscular disease would mean something affecting either the peripheral nerve, the junction, so the neuromuscular junction, or the muscle. In this case, because we have such, you know, profound neuroscience with the knuckling deficit and the decreased withdrawal, probably something affecting the peripheral nerve, you know, would be more likely, you know, than just a junctionopathy or, you know, a myopathy. Now, trying to be a bit more specific in terms of our differential diagnosis, but we could have, you know, something that we call a polyradicular neuritis. We could have something like myasthenia gravis, like a fulminating myasthenia gravis, or, you know, possibly less likely botulism, that dog didn't have any cranial nerve deficits, and in most cases of botulism, it will tend to involve as well the brainstem, so we will tend to see dysphagia or, you know, facial paralysis, so basically brainstem signs on top of the appendicular signs, you know, that we've seen. Now, it's important to suspect, you know, a neuromuscular disorder in face of such presentation. And what we would normally do is simply a minimum database, you know, to look for any electrolyte imbalance, possible, you know, signs of hypoglycemia, checking the CK, you know, that will enable, you know, to sort of evaluate the possibility of a myopathy or a myositis. Then, if possible, you know, to do something that we call a tansinin test or a neostigmine test, to try and see if we have an improvement of the sign in case we have a junctionopathy. So that's especially useful if you want to investigate the possibility of myasthenia gravis. Then, you know, you can obviously send the titers, you know, to check for acetylcholine receptor antibodies, but you won't have the result, you know, immediately. But trying to see if there is a positive response to tansinin, you know, may enable you to start treatment before you get those results. All those patients, when you have neuromuscular disorder, it's very important to do chest imaging. The reason for that is that some of them will have aspiration pneumonia, and that would be critical, you know, in terms of management, but also most patients that will tend not to improve, you know, it will actually be worse in terms of their prognosis if they do have aspiration pneumonia. And they can have it because it's not uncommon that with polyneuropathy or myasthenia gravis, you know, that you may have a megaesophagus, you know, that will make the risk of aspiration pneumonia we see much greater. Another benefit of doing the chest X-ray is that for some of those cases, it can be paraneoplastic, especially for myasthenia gravis, and you can have it, you know, following, you know, thymoma. An advanced testing would be to do EMG and nerve conduction study for those patients. That will only be done if the patient is very, very stable and, you know, is ready to be anesthetized. I think in this case, you know, it would probably be contraindicated, you know, to perform a general anesthetic. There would be concern in terms of the ability for that patient to ventilate properly, and it would probably be better to do, you know, the initial testings and later on possibly, if the patient improve, you know, an anesthetic. Muscle nerve biopsy, again, could be useful if you suspect a polyneuropathy, but it's not commonly done in the acute phase, simply, again, because you will need, you know, a general anesthetic, and it takes, you know, probably not far from 10 days, you know, to get those results, so it's not necessarily going to help you in those acute cases. Now, that patient, you know, had so something that we call, you know, an idiopathic polyradicular neuritis or Guillain-Barré syndrome, and he mostly had, you know, supportive care, as you could see on the video, bladder management with a Foley indwelling catheter, and, you know, physiotherapy and, you know, prevention of complications like pressure sores or aspiration pneumonia. What we can see on the next video that after 5 weeks, that patient actually started to have some significant improvement, you know, following, you know, all, you know, the dedication from the clients, and, you know, also from initially from the nursing staff, and you can see that even if the presentation can be very dramatic at the onset, if we are faced with this acute polyradicular neuritis, also sometimes called Guillain-Barré syndrome in people, there is definitely you know, a possibility for recovery and a good functional recovery. Now they just have to somehow do the day-to-day hard work of the physio, the bladder management, you know, the turning, and as long as you prevent complication, those patients, you know, will probably have a good chance, you know, of a satisfactory, you know, recovery. It will be important, I think, clinically to recognize, you know, the presentation, then to potentially rule out other condition, you know, and that can potentially be done, you know, by, you know, blood work without, you know, necessarily, you know, performing extremely advanced testing like EMG and muscle biopsy. Important things, if you have a neuromuscular disorder and you suspect it clinically, or we think about chest imaging to look for possible complications like aspiration pneumonia, megaloesophagus, or a mediastinal mass. So that's how we are going to end the webinar with this last case. I hope it's been useful that it will help you in your day-to-day practice to recognize some of those conditions. Thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Sebastian for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.